My name is Michael Pellett, and I teach at the University of Saskatchewan up in Saskatoon, and I'm also a pastor at one of the Lutheran congregations there in Saskatoon. And this week I will be doing four sessions on community. This is the second session, and looking at the notion of community from the sense of dwelling at the margins, and also picking up with some of the themes that from the summer program, No Longer Strangers, also the theme from Dan Erlander's Bible study of being exiled, and to kind of ask the question, how does one go about building a community, or what kind of community do we have? What kind of community would that look like if we go by the description, some of the biblical descriptions and metaphors of who we are as Christians, namely that we are a diaspora people, dispersed people, we are scattered. And yesterday, as I talked about that the metaphor of diaspora literally means torn to pieces. So how do you build a community when you're scattered and torn to pieces? Or the notion of being exiles, that we are sojourners, or only here for a short time, kind of not even worthwhile to unpack your suitcase. So if you have that sense of always being on the go, on the road, or as in the Gospels, often the phrase, on the way. Well, if you are always a people on the way, how do you build a community? Because a sense of community becomes firmed and institutionalized, and you want to have security and stability. How do exiles go about doing that? And so that was one of the things we looked at. And thirdly, this notion of being on the margins. And I talked about marginality or marginalization, not simply as a spatial metaphor in terms of being out there on the edge or on the periphery, but being on the margins in terms of a notion of power. That who we are as Christians, as Christian people, as a community of faith, that we often within our own culture and society feel powerless, or who pays attention to us? Yesterday the example was brought up on try to have anyone in the community respect Sunday morning as a time for church, or to respect one evening during the week as a time where church groups could get to. I mean, it's impossible. Forget it. Nobody cares. Right? We're powerless. We have been marginalized. Now, how do we build a community like that if we're on the margins? We looked yesterday at the book of Hebrews, and in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 13 to 16 specifically. And there the author of Hebrews says that we have this sense of not at homeness. And doing a little word play at that not at homeless or homelessness. The German word for that is unheimlich. And interestingly enough, unheimlich also means uncanny. And so that there already, that even though we feel homeless, not at home, God does the unheimlich maneuver, if you will. Uncannily makes us feel at home, that gives us the gift of community. And there I referred to Ephesians chapter 2, which is the chapter from which this summer's theme is drawn, No Longer Strangers, and there talked about God's unheimlich maneuver of the gift of community. To gather all things, to gather all people into Christ, making us who we are. It is that great gift of inclusion from God which makes us community so that we can then engage in that task of being the community of faith, the community of God's people. So that was kind of what we tried to do yesterday. Today, I want to look at this understanding of being the community of God's people. And as we are that community, and as we think about ourselves, and this is my moment of acknowledgement to Tom Evans, our geologist, I want to say that a rock is not necessarily a good metaphor for a community. Because if a community hardens and ossifies like a rock, it becomes lifeless and dead. My fancy word for this is called hermeneutico-sclerosis, a hardening of interpretation. And what happens that when a community's traditions or interpretations harden, just like when your arteries harden, what happens? Finally, they pop, they break, they explode. There's an aneurysm. And same too with communities, I think. When you undergo hermeneutical sclerosis, boy, that's a good one. When you go back home, you can tell them about that disease that is now invading the world. When your interpretations harden, that's the point where now communities, rather than being cutting edge, become like a splitting wedge. That's where we have divisiveness and the breaking apart and scattering of different groups. The interesting thing, I think, is that if you look at most of the New Testament letters, they're always written to communities suffering from hermeneutico-sclerosis, that interpretations have hardened. 1 Corinthians is the easiest letter to think about that, right? Paul is writing to a factionalized, divisive community where interpretations have hardened such that somebody says, I belong to Cephas, and someone says, I belong to Apollos, and another one says, I belong to Paul, I belong to Christ. And we've got all that factional, right? They've all got their own little rock. And of course, their rock is the right rock, right? On this rock, I will build the church, right? And all of a sudden, we become rocky. So, to look at that, how do we still remain this dynamic community on the cutting edge and not have that kind of hardening and not have that kind of divisiveness? That's the question for tonight that I'd like to explore with you and also get your feedback. To start it out, let's start out from the idyllic and wonderful point of view. And what could be more idyllic and wonderful than this poem by Pamela Haynes, which is what all of your church council meetings and all of the meetings that you attend in your communities look like, right? So let's just, and part of the challenge here is just simply, can you read my writing? If you can do that, it's already halfway successful. This is just simply by the poet Pamela Haynes, a meeting. And she writes, a community of friends, all their antennae out, weaving together a fabric of agreement. How much listening can a room hold? In a sea of ambiguity, each one takes a turn, catching a thread of clarity and offering it to the rest. Caring, sensitive fingers, probing the tangle of ideas, sorting the threads, tying loose ends, thoughtfully, holding the pattern that might be in the mind's eye, the skill and the patience, intelligence and creativity of a dozen lovers, feeling, thinking, building with fine familiar tools in an uncharted land. the perfect description of a Holden board meeting. Right, Gertrude? Gertrude's on the board, she knows. Are there any other board members here?
Carol's,
but right, Carol?
Oh, yeah.
This obviously, Pamela Haynes has sat in on our meetings. She knows how they go. Is this how your church council meetings go? Is this how you work as a community of faith?
I think the second line, probably.
All there and ten
that
out?
That one would fit, yeah.
Yeah.
What is it to tell?
I thought about that one too, and I wondered how sharp those antennae are, right? I wanted to kind of hone that to a razor edge. You know, cynic and skeptic that I am, there's kind of two words in this whole thing that I like. So I'll show you my prejudices right away. Ambiguity and, this is kind of one word, right? Pattern that might be. I think she's got something there. All right, most of our meetings, most of our senses of agreement have that notion of ambiguity. And I think that a community that's working, and this is again this cutting edge stuff, the pattern that might be, because I think important, my way of looking at that is we as a community, when we gather together to deliberate, to think about the ways in which we should go, try to explore and think through possibilities. And so we as communities hold possibilities out in front of us. And that's where one has disagreement, because possibilities mean that there are various ways of going. And at one point, if we decide to actualize one possibility, it means that we might marginalize someone else who wants to take a different path, a different kind of possibility. But what about some of these other things? What in this poem catches your attention in terms of what you think is involved in part of being community? Right? Not just simply when it has a meeting, a gathering, but is there anything in here that kind of captures and describes, even if it is idealistic, what you think it is to be community, and particularly a community of faith?
I like the last two lines. Building with fine familiar tools in an uncharted land.
Okay. And what do you like about those lines?
Well, the idea that you're working with fine familiar tools, you have a knowledge of how you work together, and you're going somewhere off into the future, which is uncharted territory, and you can do it because you've got a system with these people.
Yeah, that any community is always struggling between the known and the unknown, isn't it? And you hope you have a good enough sense of the known that will lead you into that unknown in a way that's productive and creative and good for the whole. Yeah. Well, yes.
The probing of the tangle of ideas.
Okay, and what do you like about that?
Because I think that's what we do in meetings and in belief and everything else. We have a tangle of ideas or thoughts, and somewhere by probing we come up with a consensus of belief or action.
Okay, but some people have a tough time with probing, don't they? Right? Some people find probing very threatening. Right? They kind of just simply poking. What are you doing? Poking around in that. What are you doing? Raising all those questions again. How come you're the troublemaker on our committee?
That happens a lot.
Right? So that probing again has one of those, it kind of cuts both ways. That indeed, if one wouldn't probe, right away you're back to the rock, right? Hermeneutic goes hardening of interpretations. But to probe is already seen by some as threatening. They're not quite sure what to do about that. Any other phrases?
Each one takes a turn.
Each one takes a turn.
You can hear those marginal voices.
Okay. So that notion there of, what can we say, that this has a notion of inclusivity with it? The marginal voices get heard. There's not just simply one person dictating, domineering. Anything else?
Catching a thread of clarity, that sort of implies that there's not one person with all the insight.
Okay. Okay, so that
to achieve clarity, it's going to take a number of people.
So that again, there is that notion that it is a community effort or a cooperative effort. Mm-hmm. That no one has the market on ideas, and again, clear ideas.
I think that's important too. That the idea of a thread of clarity in this tangle. It's not unlike this pattern that might be, or an uncharted land, that there's some hopefulness here that out of the tangle and loose ends, and even in the midst of ambiguity, there's something worth being together for. Because I'm like you, the ambiguity attracts me, but there comes a time when you want to at least find enough clarity to be able to move to the next step.
Yeah. I always think about that too in terms of teaching, that on the one hand, ambiguity is attractive, but on the other hand, during final exams, if a student writes an essay and it's ambiguous, that's not particularly helpful for their final mark, right? You're looking for some clarity. And so again, there's that sense, tangle of ideas and clarity that work together and work with it. Okay, keeping this in mind, let's see what kind of advice we might want to give to Jesus as to how well he's following this as he does a little deliberating, and as the disciples do as well. Would you turn to Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 to 28? And I'm going to read it. If you'd follow along, please. I did my own translating from the Greek in order to kind of to push some words and some senses here, so you can follow along. Matthew 15, 21 to 28. And Jesus got out of that place and withdrew into the part of the region known as Tyre and Sidon. And wouldn't you know it, a Canaanite woman from those whereabouts came out and began screaming, saying, "Have pity on me, Lord, Son of David! My daughter is cruelly tormented by a demon!" But he did not say a word. And his disciples went up to him, and imploring him, said, "Get rid of her, for she keeps on screaming at us." And answering, he said to them, "I was sent exclusively for the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt in front of him, saying, Lord, come to my aid. He replied, it is not morally acceptable to take food away from children and throw it to the dogs. But she said, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's sumptuously set table. Then answering, Jesus said to her, O woman, great is your faith. Let it become for you as you will. And her daughter was healed at that instant.
Would you like to take on the whole book?
What do you mean, what would I like to take?
Like a palette translation of the whole book.
Give me till tomorrow. refer to your own translate. The reason I picked this text in particular is because it didn't have any Greek, tough Greek words and I could translate. No. Is because it's talking about margins, isn't it? Right. Even the place where this is happening, it's happening on the margins. We're not quite sure. It's in that region known as Tyre and Sidon, but we're right on the boundary, if you will, we're on this boundary. We're not quite sure whether Jesus is up here in this boundary or whether the woman kind of crossed over a little bit up here, right? It's just in these whereabouts. But it's a wonderfully ambiguous phrase, isn't it? Because even though we're in those whereabouts, we're in this boundary situation where you don't quite know where anybody's at. Okay? It's not clearly defined. And the whole chapter of Matthew, chapter 15, has been talking about boundaries and about community and tradition. For example, Matthew 15, verses 2 and 3. Right. The Pharisees and the scribes come to Jesus and say, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands before they eat. He answered them, and why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? Hermeneuticosclerosis has set in, hasn't it? Right? That's the problem. What's the tradition? And do you wash your hands or not? We're right there on the boundaries. It's a tough question. Later on, verse 6. Here's Jesus' harsh indictment against them. Chapter 15, verse 6. So for the sake of your tradition, you make void the word of God. And whenever I read that passage, I can't help but think of Fiddler on the Roof, right? Where Tevye has all right, tradition. But right, he's still got a strut. You can see I'm not going in the variety show, right? I'm not singing. But he's always stretching. There's tradition and yet what confronts him with his daughters, what confronts him in life, he has to stretch. He's always on the boundaries. Now, can a community do that? Or is it going to hold to its tradition so hard, so fast, so stolid and stodgy like a rock that it finally voids or invalidates the life-giving word which we claim as a community of faith we're centered around? that the Word of God is to give us life and to be life, not to be hard and ossified and death-like. And so that's the challenge. Or again, one more thing to set the context. Verses 17 and 18 of chapter 15. Do you not see that whatever goes into the mouth enters the stomach and goes out into the sewer? But what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this is what defiles. I think Jesus has just got a great sense of humor. I think you should read this and you're supposed to laugh. Right? Yeah. What he's saying is, it's not that what comes out of this end that's dirty, it's what comes out of this end that's dirty, or could be dirty, right? This is what defiles. And why would that defile? What comes out of your mouth, those words, if they are words of hate, if they are words of exclusion, if they are words of death, are words that invalidate, that kill. And that's what's destructive to community. And so given that whole context, right, here immediately Matthew throws Jesus and the whole disciples, the little community, right onto the borders, onto the boundaries, and what's going to happen? We have two episodes then going on. Verses 22 to 24. I call that first episode centering on the woman, the nuisance. When the disciples come and say, get rid of her, what they are basically saying is, do whatever you have to do so she won't embarrass us anymore. She says that again, that for the disciples, one should conduct one's ministry by acting in a way that would avoid anything that would displease people. One should avoid disquieting confrontations. Have you ever been in a community that will try to avoid confrontation? That will try to avoid conflict at all costs? Yeah. Could that at all happen to the Christian community?
Well, I think especially when you're on the margin.
Especially when you're on the margin.
Because you don't want to call attention to yourself.
Yes.
Being loud.
That's right.
And disruptive.
And disruptive.
There's always a price to pay.
There's always a price to pay. What will others think if somehow those people are also associated with us? And of course, we all know who those people are. We all have our favorite candidates for those people, don't we? Sometimes that's in terms of ethnicity, sometimes that's in terms of gender, sometimes that's in terms of economics, sometimes that's in terms of sexual orientation. But it's those people. And so, right? They're nuisances. Do whatever you have to do to get rid of them. Say what you gotta say. Avoid the confrontation. Interestingly enough, I think that Jesus' initial reaction is to draw a boundary. Even though she is bothersome by her cries, Jesus does not act in response to either her or the disciples' wishes, but acts according to his calling, his vocatio, his mission, where he says, I was sent exclusively to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. You can always rely on Jesus to take a bad situation and make it worse. Right? That's just the wonderful thing about the Messiah. He always makes it worse. If you thought it was bad enough, he will make it worse. And again here, pushing and upping the ante, saying, you know, even disciples, don't worry about that. It's not even our community problem, because after all, I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel. Now, the great thing is, Israel is down here somewhere. You have to wonder if he is sent, if Jesus is sent to the lost sheep of Israel, what's he doing wandering around in that boundary territory, Gentile pagan land of Tyre and Sidon? What wonderful irony. I was sent exclusively, and it's their ook a me, right? Three negatives right in a row, so you it really is exclusive. Exclusively to the lost sheep of Israel. And so that's why he's hanging out there in pagan territory. The other thing, too, about the word lost in the Greek can be used in other senses in terms of talking about crumbs and spoiled food or ruined wine or whatever, that the term for lost is whatever is always kind of gone, what you lose, right? Like it, when you eat food and you've got the crumbs or it spoils, it's lost. Stray sheep, well, you know, they become a tax write-off because there's always that kind of risk, right? They're the lost. And so it's that word play that, if you will, this Syrophoenician woman, this Canaanite woman, hears and picks up on with this notion of lostness, to even challenge the boundary that Jesus seems at first to set. And so we come to episode 2, which I call the questioning. And here is where Jesus again says, I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel. And then the woman hears that, pleads, come to my aid. And Jesus' second response is, it is not morally acceptable to take food away from children and throw it to the dogs. The contrast here between children and dogs is again a contrast between who are the insiders in the community, those who enjoy privileged status, and those who are outside, and therefore those for whom nothing applies because it doesn't make any difference. They don't count. They're not people. And so that, again, communities have that way in giving you identity. That sense of belongingness to a community is what gives you identity and worth and value. And it's so easy then at that point to also say, and those who are outside of that community basically have no identity, no worth, no value, and in fact, if you mess around with them at the expense of your own community, that's an immoral action. Right? Just like it would be immoral to rip food from the mouths of your children to feed a stray dog. You know, what kind of parent would you be if you would allow your children to starve so all the stray dogs in your neighborhood would be fed? Right? Immoral. That's what Jesus is saying. I can't do that, right? I'm part of a community. I gotta feed that community. I'm here to feed God's children, not you pagan dogs. And then comes her wonderful response. In recognizing that, she picks up on that metaphor and she recognizes that indeed her request does not divert Jesus' focus from community, but extends it. When she says, yes, but even the dogs eat from the crumbs of the table. Right. That the whole, I think the whole problem here again, and I'm gonna erase our half a poem or some of it for a moment, is that being a community on the margins, when requests are made of us, when we are asked to do things differently, we always think that at that point we have to divert our resources such that someone else in the community gets less or doesn't get anything or has to get something up, and we think about it in terms of this notion of diverting rather than simply in terms of extending. Let me be risky, because communities always are risky, and think about that in terms of the issue around the ordination of gay and lesbian people. One of the issues, and I think a primary issue there, is some people are so afraid that if we do that, or you even hear these comments, what are we doing diverting all our attention to those people? And then we start this kind of propaganda ploy as though somehow they become the center of attention and they are the center. And if we pay attention to them, then somehow the rest of us are going to suffer neglect. Rather than seeing it again simply as the opportunity of extending who we are, who they are, as baptized people of God, and saying, right, no one is diverted from anything. No one is neglected. But God's generosity, God's benefits, God's gifts to the whole church are given to us through not the diversion, but the diversity of people. And so there, that whole question now of the border, right? What do we want to do? Do we want to extend our borders and our boundaries, or do we want to reinforce them? Do we want to build the bulwarks and make sure that no one can cross those borders, that no one can get in? And so we really heighten and intensify the notion of insiders and outsiders, of those who receive benefits and those who are not even worthy of any benefit whatsoever, of those who belong and of those who don't belong. I don't know. What's your response, your thinking as you maybe have a chance to mull a little bit on this story? What does it help you see, understand about community?
Well, a community, if it doesn't grow, it's gonna die. And by extending and including those that are on the border themselves or want to come in, we benefit by it.
Mm-hmm. But do you want people to come in if they're different than you? Or do you want to grow by like-mindedness?
I think
like cloning would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Cloning would be boring.
Okay. But in many senses, right, that's what some communities want to do. They would love to clone if they could, as long as people, right, as long as it would be a community that is just like me, In fact, well, we know this isn't true, right? If there would be 30 of me, wouldn't that be wonderful? I've got a hard enough time living with me. I hate it.
But it's interesting to me that the church growth folks still talk about this in terms of if you want to grow, you get the people that are just like you. But it seems to me that it's exactly at the margins that you have some real chance to grow. I mean, just if you think about it, you can think about it in terms of who are the best people in your congregation to bring in new folks. Well, it isn't the old ones. It isn't the ones that have been there forever. It's the ones that have just come in. They know people that haven't been invited and haven't turned them down yet. Or if you think in terms of worship stuff, we're always being challenged at the margins. That is, somebody says, well, I want this kind of music. But, you know, it seems to me that the trick is in the balance. You don't give over all decisions to the margins, but you don't cut off the margins from being heard either. And it's not as easy as sometimes it's portrayed, nor is it as difficult as sometimes portrayed.
I think of the great obstacle that I often hear to real progress. We've always done it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of mentality of the cloning idea would probably appeal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my experience in terms of the parish is that usually if you can do something twice, then everyone will think that you've always done it that way. I mean, it really doesn't take too long to start a tradition. And that's both good and bad.
Well, it doesn't matter if you've always, whether you've always done it that way or not. That,
right.
It's almost, it becomes a code word for, let's not do that.
Right, yeah.
It's always seemed strange to me that in the United States we adapt our food, the likes and dislikes, to all types and places and everything else. And yet when we go to a Thai or Chinese restaurant, they serve us. We accept what they bring, but not accept them. And as soon as we put a name on them, then we begin, they're Joe or Sally or whatever, then they become, it no longer is they, along with the food that they bring and the customs that they bring and the art, we then can adjust to them. But it's very hard to put names on people that are outside your community.
Michael, I think that this contrast you've set up between diverting and extending, it's fruitful, but it's easier if you think of it in contrast between one thing or another. If you extend the boundaries, that sounds really nice. But if it's about resources, then it sounds a little different. And if the resource is something limited, which this metaphor is, how much bread is there? If there's plenty, it's easy to talk about extending. If there's not plenty, it seems like diverting. And when we talk about the gospel, of course, we think, well, there's plenty of that, so that's not a diversion. But when we think about some other things that there is a limit to, then it's harder. I have to admit that. It's harder when it's something there's only enough of. And what she does, what this woman does that's so brilliant is the crumbs have fallen anyway. So it's no loss to the children. That's an easy extension. But if it's as you described it, take it away from the children and give it to the dogs, that's harder.
Well, I think that woman was pointing out that there is enough. And if you have a mindset of abundance, then you can, and that includes a faith that, yes, there is enough bread, just like there were enough fishes,
right,
miraculously. And the attitude of abundance changes your actions.
interesting to think of healing as a commodity that has limits, in terms of healthcare, I suppose, then you get into economics, but it's interesting to, this woman is tough-minded enough and single-minded enough to push Jesus a little bit on what is it going to cost for you to say what would be the most important thing for me to hear and for my daughter. I mean, what is it going to cost? Mm-hmm. It's not like taking, it isn't the same thing as taking bread from children.
Well, it's worse, right? I mean, again, when you put it within this whole context of the controversy that Jesus has been having in terms of the purity laws of the Jewish tradition at that point, right? The controversy, clean, unclean, to extend himself in this way, again, clearly puts him in opposition to the beloved religious tradition, right?
Keep bringing up the tradition. I'm thinking that in the last few years, the Lutherans have grouped they and them and us into a concise, cohesive unit, and now we're asking to do that again, and I personally have had some problems with it. For all of the reasons of protecting my Lutheranism, I have not for the growth that will come from the ecumenical with the other churches.
Yeah, those pagan Episcopalians, oh, right? Yeah, I mean that again. It's a marvelous example. How do we understand that as we try to somehow bring together or gather into one these two communities of faith? And on the one hand, you would say, right, well, it's the gospel. I mean, isn't there enough gospel to go around for both? But there's still that notion of protection, a sense of stability and security, that sense of, yeah, but, you know, they don't quite do the gospel the way we do the gospel. And obviously, they're wrong and we're right. So there's a little problem there. I mean, that's that whole sense, again, of that maybe where's the thread of clarity amidst all this tangle, amidst this ambiguity?
Well, a couple wrinkles here. One is it might be worth noticing that it's for the sake of healing that the boundaries are pushed. Okay? And they're not pushed for the sake of pushing the boundaries.
Right.
It's because of mercy, pity.
Right. Yeah.
It's not in order to, you know, consolidate bureaucracies or something.
Right.
But
yes.
It's for the sake of healing. And only the urgency of this mother who is desperate has forced this extension, diversion. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that strikes me. And another is that Jesus does come from somewhere. I mean, he starts with the house of Israel. And so he does have a tradition, not in the negative sense that tradition is being used in his sayings against tradition here. But he's not just like free-floating spiritual force or something, right? He has a history and he comes from that. And that's a good thing, even for this Syrophoenician woman, it's a good thing, or the Canaanite woman, I'm sorry. It's a good thing for her that he's grounded in that whole story, even though it's not her story, right? So it doesn't, I wouldn't say it argues against all.
Well, those are two very good comments, and I think as I want to take this too, the notion there again of extending is precisely for a purpose. Mm-hmm. It's for the purpose of healing, and I would also want to argue for the purpose of justice. And again, here I always make a contrast between things that entail justice and things that entail order. That sometimes the sake of good order is not necessarily just. Right? That's again the problem that Jesus sees with his own tradition, is that they've become so rock hard about preserving the order that they think now that God is a God of order rather than a God of justice. And so there's that ongoing sense, if you will. Jesus too is appealing to the tradition, the same tradition that his opponents are appealing to say, you know, if you will, he's saying, hey folks, read your Bibles. Go to Dan Erlander's Bible class in the morning on 2nd Isaiah, and you'll find out what? That it is a God of justice, a God of healing, a God who wants to announce good news to all the nations. That's not outside our tradition. That's the nuts and bolts of the tradition.
So it's interesting that when the disciples' reason for sending her away is she's shouting too much.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But Jesus' reason is more grounded in this tradition of Israel, which now he's going to extend.
Right.
So that's a better reason than the she's shouting too much reason.
Right.
Right. But what we don't know is what happens to her afterwards. So what we don't know about the consequence of this story is whether she now is included in the community or whether she has benefited from the resources of the community. Jesus has healed her daughter, and that's it. I don't know exactly what you do with that, except to say I don't think you want to say too easily that Jesus has now brought everybody in, although it would be nice if he said that, but it's not in the text.
But as often is the case, the story remains open. Right,
yeah.
there's a ambiguity. It's not resolved, but we are left with ambiguity, almost saying, yeah, and what happens next?
So how
and
do we
I think
know
there
the
it comes back to us and says
that she came back and told him, or you know, it's not like the text we had on Sunday when Jesus goes to the house and sees that the daughter is alive and instructs her to be fed. We don't know what the long-term consequences are.
And so there maybe the question is, well, community of faith, what are you doing about that? What are you doing with the Canaanite women in your midst? Up there, please, and then we'll go back to time.
I just want to say your comment about the woman screaming is what they were upset about. Just a woman coming in front of Jesus was enough for the disciples to become disturbed about. And I think it's a little bit unfortunate that we haven't talked about that to some extent, that not only a Canaanite, but a woman had enough courage to come before Jesus and challenge him, which I believe she did, but was part of kind of what happened this morning in talking about 2nd Isaiah, the challenging God to say, wait a second, something's wrong here. This woman came and said, wait a second, Jesus, you're saying all this, but here I am. What about me? And I think that she played, again, an unnamed woman, but played a very important part in the development of Jesus' ministry.
I think that's a very good point.
I think there's another story going on here too in the background. This is like a long field trip with the disciples, sort of a practicum, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's leading up to the loaves and fishes. And
right.
So very pointedly at them. You know, this is how you do things.
And did they get it?
Well, he keeps having to make these points over and over.
Yeah. And at least initially, they didn't get it.
No.
No. it becomes tough.
It's interesting that the story about the fishes is in the next part of this chapter.
Right.
Just after they've been talking about the crumbs, they go and all of a sudden there's enough food for people.
And a lot of crumbs left.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, that notion, and all were satisfied.
Abundance.
There's that sense of abundance that our fear, even with regard to resources, you're right, that yet somehow, even if they might be diverted, it seems like no one suffers from neglect. And again, I think that's the fear that we have, because again, that whole notion of, I think, developing community, we're always after security and stability. And that notion then of somehow extending is perceived as a threat to our security and stability. And so that when somebody comes and challenges us, if you will, has the courage to come and challenge. I think again, we often immediately want to caricature someone who might challenge us in the community as a troublemaker, as a nuisance, as an outsider, rather than recognizing the tremendous amount of courage that it takes to do that, to be, that I don't think people naturally like to be nuisances and complainers. The situation has gotten to such a point that what encourage, they speak out. And there again we can see the disciples' total misperception, because rather than recognizing this woman's courage or need or anything in good self-centered fashion, they were just so embarrassed and put off by that, you know, whatever is expedient to get rid of her. Which is, again, the way we as communities, for our sake of stability and security, would often like to take. What's the expedient way of getting this done for, out of the way? So that even if we're on the margins, we still tend to marginalize, particularly in that sense of power. Because again, I think stability and security and our identity with that are tied up with notions of power. And what do we do to maintain power or control? I've got a little list here, just to go through quick, in terms of some of that. As I look at this story and what it tells us about community and who we are as a community, I think that we recognize that the community of faith is a risking community. We are willing to take risks. That we are a provoking community, that we kind of provoke things rather than try to fend things off or to try to kind of cover ourselves with some kind of lamination so that we're impermeable and impervious to everything, but we're willing to be provoked. That we go for a sense of deepening rather than of distancing. That we are willing to become engaged rather than detached. That we want to, here's my garage metaphor, plumb the depths of a situation and test its trueness rather than simply dissect something and cut it up and see what the pieces are. A true community, I think, and Jesus exhibits this, leads rather than controls. It calls and invites rather than commands and directs. And it tries to create new possibilities rather than always measuring how accurate one is to the past traditions and possibilities. So the kind of thing is, it's asking, who are we? Who are we becoming? Rather than saying always, how am I doing? And did I do it right? Right. And again, we love to measure. Even in education, there's always that, you know, can you do the assessment? Can you assess this right away? And basically, all those notions of assessment are in terms of measurement. And can it be quantified? And can you give a percentage? So, rather than saying, was this creative? Did it open up new possibilities? Did it enliven people? Did it give life? Was there healing? Was there justice? Or not? And so I think that, again, is a sense for who we are as communities on the margins. That's what keeps us as cutting edge.